Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. View A, Israel, Iran, and the United States are maneuvering at the brink of war. View B, they're just playing out a very complex war dance before, maybe, the diplomatic dawn. The signals are all over the map. Missile tests, war games, red lines, green lights, and amber lights. Then this morning's news that a top State Department official will join nuclear talks with Iran. But does that signal breakthrough or last chance? This hour on Point, behind the saber rattling and diplomacy, we try to weigh the real possibility of war with Iran. We'll get the view from a nervous Israel in just a moment, but joining me first from Washington is Jonathan Karl, senior national security correspondent for ABC News. Jonathan, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's a couple of weeks ago now that you were reporting that top Pentagon officials were concerned that Israel could carry out an attack on Iraq's nuclear facilities before the end of this year and were pressuring them not to do that. What's happened since then?
Well, the concern is still there. There's been a lot that's happened since then on the diplomatic front, where the Iranians, for the first time in a long time, have signaled a willingness to at least talk about suspending that enrichment program, which is a significant change. So there's been some movement on the diplomatic front. The Europeans have moved forward on sanctions. But in terms of that fundamental concern from the U.S. military, the Israelis, even as all this is playing out, will, if they feel that Iran has crossed a couple of red lines, either getting that enrichment program to the point where it can produce what it needs to fuel a nuclear weapon, or if they get this SA-20 missile defense system, that the Israelis would act. And that is something that the U.S. military very much would like not to see happen.
SA-20 air defense system, they're buying it from Russia. It's supposed to come in pretty soon. Then yesterday we get former U.N. ambassador, U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, John Bolton, a Bush favorite, writing in the Wall Street Journal that Iranians being willing to talk about uranium enrichment and pushing ahead on their alleged nuclear weapons front are two sides of the same foreign policy coin. He says, odds are Israel may have to act here, and the United States, if they do, will be drawn in no matter what, so we might as well support them and help them.
And you know, John Bolton has had a view like this for a long time. He's pointedly not in the administration right now, and it's interesting in terms of U.S. policy on this is being steered largely now out of the State Department. And you saw this decision, you referred to it in the beginning of the show, of William Burns, the number three official in the State Department, now sitting down with the Iranians, of course not one-on-one talks, but in the context of these the so-called P5 plus one talks with the Iranians. And the U.S. is backing this European proposal that would basically call for a freeze for a freeze. Now, what this means is that the Iranians would still be allowed to continue their current program, but would agree not to expand it. And in exchange for that, the Europeans and the top, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council would agree to, stop any further sanction activity. So this is the kind of policy that drives the likes of John Bolton crazy.
But there's been this intense traffic back and forth between the U.S. and Israel. I wish you could give us some interpretation here. Of course, at the end of late June, we had our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, in Israel, talking with top officials there. And then you had Ehud Barak scheduled to arrive in Washington on Monday, putting that off a little bit because of the Hezbollah prisoner and remains swap. Chief of the Israeli Defense Forces due in Washington in a couple of days. Head of Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, due very soon. Barack Obama, of course, headed out there. But all that military back and forth, is that planning for something or debating whether something should happen?
I think it's as far as we know, there's a little bit of each going on there. But you're right, it's been an extraordinary back and forth of military to military meetings, visits between the Israelis and the Americans. Mullen has been there three times since becoming chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And this was not typically a stop for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Peter Pace, I believe, never visited Israel as chairman. I believe it had been a number of years, since the last time we had a chairman visit. And here you have Mullen, who's, you know, been in that job less than a year, and he's already been there three times. So all I can tell you, though, when Mullen came back from his last visit, there was a clear sense from the people on the joint staff, senior officials, of concern about the Israelis, and their legitimate concern. They understand the concern about Iran, but a concern as reflected in the report, which you referred to from 2 weeks ago, my report, that the Israelis are serious about this, and they don't believe the diplomatic effort is going anywhere in terms of stopping or slowing down the Iranian program. They didn't believe there was any real hope in that, and they were, you know, very serious about taking matters into their own hands and unilateral Israeli strike. The U.S. military does not want any part of that.
Admiral Mullen seeming to indicate that, as you say, they don't want it, but if Israel attacks, the U.S. would get sucked into it, even if it's against American interests.
There's just no question that, and the Iranians have been very clear on this, that if the Israelis went forward with an attack, the Iranians would view that as an American attack. First of all, the Israelis would be flying American-made planes, dropping American-made armaments. I was at a meeting right as this was all happening 2 weeks ago at the Iranian mission to the UN with the Iranian foreign minister and a small group of reporters. And when we asked him about this idea that the Israelis would do this unilateral strike, he was totally dismissive, saying the Israelis simply don't have that capability, and after their experience in Lebanon in 2006, there's no way the Israelis could do that. Now, another way of reading that his comment is that he's saying that if there is a strike, it's not the Israelis alone. It's the Israelis with American help.
It would be with American help. There's talk of an amber light having been given, reported in Haaretz and elsewhere, that George Bush has given Israel an amber light to begin preparations for military attack. And then, of course, Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker, and talking beyond, saying we've already got special forces, U.S. special forces inside Iran, hundreds of millions appropriated for activity there, preparing the battlefield, the phrase there.
Yeah, you know, and of course, Cy Hersh has been writing a similar story for a couple of years now, and I'm not, you know, who knows exactly who he's talking to. It seemed like he was talking to a number of foreign officials and maybe some people on the Hill. I don't get the sense from people high levels in the military that there is any kind of, you know, we have explicit denials that there are U.S. special forces operating right now in Iran, but clearly there are a lot of signals out there. As Gates referred to, we asked Gates about all this stuff last week, and he said there's a lot of signaling going on. But the bottom line, from the U.S. military perspective, is that war with Iran right now would be disastrous. It would be disastrous for a couple of reasons. Probably first and foremost is what it would mean for Iraq. The situation in Iraq has finally seemed to maybe even turned a corner. All bets are off if there's an attack on Iran, because Iran's first counter response could very easily be right in their own backyard, jeopardizing all the gains that we've seen in Iraq over the last several months. That is the last thing that anybody in the U.S. military wants to see, and I think the last thing that anybody in the Bush administration would want to see.
But it doesn't mean, necessarily, that it won't happen. Jonathan Karl, national security correspondent with ABC News, joining us from Washington. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's go quickly before the break to Tel Aviv, Israel, and Emily Landau, director of the Arms Control and Regional Security Program at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. Emily Landau, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So what's the temperature in Israel right now on the threat from Iran? We saw some very bellicose statements for several weeks out of Israel, and of course the war games that got attention over the Mediterranean. What's the fever right now?
Well, there definitely is a sense that temperatures are rising somewhat. But I think just referring to what we just heard, you know, there's talk about the concern being Israel. Of course, the real concern here is Iran. And I think we shouldn't be taken off track in terms of what the real issue is here. And I think that, you know, the two real alternatives for dealing with the Iranian issue are either you broker a deal with Iran, and that way you deal with the situation, or you say that there's nothing we can do, and Iran will ultimately become a nuclear state. I think you need to understand the whole issue of military action or threats of military action in terms of the role that these things play in the context of these two alternatives. And what I mean by that is, if you want to go for a deal, if you want negotiations, if you're serious about diplomacy, first of all, you have to think about what will work. But second of all, you have to look back at the history of the past 5 years, the failed negotiations with the European Union. And you have to realize, I think, that unless Iran feels real pressure, it's not going to go into serious negotiations.
Sounds like you're saying recent history would lean toward conflict.
Well, that's not what I mean to say.
We'll come back and get it in more detail. Emily Lindau in Tel Aviv, please stand by. We're looking at the possibility of war with Iran. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour behind the saber rattling and diplomacy to try to gauge the real possibility of war with Iran. Here's a quick sound montage courtesy of the BBC with the sound of missile launches, those test missile launches as broadcast on Iranian state TV, and a defiant message to the West from General Hossein Salami, commander of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard ground forces.
We want to tell the world that those who conduct their foreign policy by using the language of threat against Iran, they have to know that our finger is always on the trigger, and we have hundreds and even thousands of missiles ready to be fired against predetermined targets. We will chase the enemies on the ground and in the sky, and we are able to react strongly to enemy threats in the shortest possible time.
And here is Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak reacting last week to the Iranian missile tests, warning Iran that a military strike is not out of the question.
Israel is the strongest country in the region, and as it has proved, it does not recoil from acting when its vital security interests are at stake. Israel is very strong, but that does not mean we are immune to our adversaries' reactions.
Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak, former Prime Minister. We're joined from Tel Aviv by Emily Lindau at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. And right now from Washington by Trita Parsi, President of the National Iranian American Council, author of Treacherous Alliance, formerly professor in international relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. Trita Parsi, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It looks like a balance here. There's a minuet underway. There's talk of talking. And now we've got Burns, the highest-ranking American to talk with Iranians in a long, long time, headed for Europe to do just that. But all these war dance signals at the same time. We'll hear more from Emily Lindau in Tel Aviv. But how do you gauge the balance here? Are we leaning toward a deal? Are we leaning toward war? Can the status quo go on?
I don't think the status quo is tenable, and that's why both sides are trying to argue stronger for either war or for diplomacy. I would personally interpret the latest rounds of bluster from both Tehran and Tel Aviv to be the prelude to the negotiations that are about to take place. I think from the Iranian side, they want to make sure that they don't come across as weak as they potentially enter into negotiations. Rather, they want to be portrayed or be seen as doing so from a position of strength.
And Emily Lindau, you heard Jonathan Carl with ABC saying there that the U.S. military sees war with Iran right now as disastrous for U.S. Interests. Could Israel do it without deeply involving the United States, a strike on Iranian nuclear capacity, Emily?
Yeah, well, just to follow up on what I was saying before, I mean, I don't think that we are necessarily leading now into a conflict. I think that these, you know, the threatening language that you hear. By the way, Ehud Barak's statement also included the fact that he said that Israel still favors diplomacy. Israel views diplomacy as the way to go forward. Okay. But I think the recent threats are an indication of the fact that Israel is indeed frustrated with the negotiations that we've seen so far. And I think that Israel's not the only one that is frustrated with those negotiations.
Of course.
I think the United States also realizes that these negotiations have led nowhere, that Iran, in fact, has been using negotiations in order to buy time, in order to progress with its nuclear program. And this was reflected most clearly by the latest report that was issued by the IAEA. So I don't think things are leading in the direction necessarily of conflict, but I think that these threats of war play a role in terms of putting a different kind of pressure on Iran so that Iran finally reaches the point where they do want to enter negotiations in order to actually negotiate a deal, not just to be engaged in negotiations and push its nuclear program forward. And here I think we are seeing very initial indications that we might perhaps be on the verge of that kind of negotiation. And if that is the case, it's very good news. And it also helps you understand how the whole issue of military action ties into, again, these two alternatives that we have. Either we negotiate a deal or we accept a nuclear Iran. And I don't think anyone in the international community wants to accept a nuclear Iran. Not the United States, not Europe, not Israel, and not Iran's regional neighbors. Let's not forget Iran's regional neighbors who are very, very threatened by what's going on in Iran.
So, reporting of the pressure in Iran, I'm reading today food prices in Iran, 50% inflation in Tehran, daily power cuts, water shortages, big lines at petrol, at gas stations. So, there is some of that pressure already. Trita Parsi, how do you read this? I mean, Emily Landau suggests you've got to have the military pressure, the military threat to get a response on another front. But can that be contained? Do we risk tipping over? Are we close enough to that red line that Israel may just decide we've got to go?
Well, first of all, I think the idea that military pressure or these type of threats coming out of Israel, that they are helpful towards pushing this towards a negotiated solution, is mistaken. If military pressure is the reason why Iran is showing greater flexibility, potentially, now we can't be 100% sure, towards a negotiated solution, then it begs the question, why wasn't the Iranians more convinced by the military threats of the United States 2 years ago, when the United States had far more credibility in making such threats? At the time, the Iranians completely dismissed any threats from the United States and did not show any willingness to come to the table and potentially discuss suspension. So I'm not convinced at all that these military threats in any way, shape, or form are helpful. On the contrary, I think they are part of the problem. I think if we want to see diplomacy succeed, we actually have to pursue diplomacy. And we haven't pursued diplomacy for the last 2.5 years. There's been a precondition that has prevented talks from taking place, and I think it's a very positive step and a course correction by the State Department right now to send Bill Burns to the talks in Geneva.
The precondition of an end to uranium enrichment, you mean?
Sorry, exactly, uranium enrichment, in order to show that the United States is serious about diplomacy. I think that's extremely critical and a very, very positive step that the Bush administration should be commended for.
I want to bring another voice into this conversation from Washington. We're joined by James Dobbins, director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. He held senior White House and State Department positions under 4 presidents, most recently serving as the Bush administration's special envoy, ambassadorial status for Afghanistan. Ambassador Dobbins, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure, thank you.
What do you see going on with the news of William Burns headed to Geneva? Is this a sign that the diplomatic path is gaining strength here, or are we indeed at risk of armed conflict with Iran?
Well, I think there is some risk. I think the risk is diminished recently. I think the diplomatic path and the State Department's preferences are clearly dominant at the moment, but I think it's a mistake to assume that either Iranian or American, or for that matter Israeli policies, are fully integrated and that the right hand always knows what the left hand is doing and is in full agreement with it. The Bush administration has been badly divided on this issue throughout its tenure. The Iranian regime is also divided politically and policy-wise. And so it's not prudent to assume that there is, in every case, a master plan and that these are fully integrated moves. But at the moment, it does appear that President Bush has lent his weight to the negotiating track. It does appear that Israel has been signaled to back off any imminent plans for military action. Certainly the decision to send the Undersecretary of State to negotiate with the Iranians is a breathtaking departure from the administration's position of, say, a year ago on this issue.
Ambassador, walk us through then, if there's no master plan, walk us through some of the military realities here. Could Israel indeed mount some kind of effective strike on Iran without American participation? Is the United States in position in Iran and elsewhere in the Persian Gulf and beyond to support an Israeli attack, or too tied down in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere? Give us the calculus there.
Well, it depends on what you mean by American participation. Israel, in order to strike Iran, would have to overfly either Iraq, Saudi Arabia, or Turkey. And it might get over the first time, but then 3 or 4 hours later it would have to fly back again, by which time those countries and their air forces would have been alerted and it might be more difficult. It's possible that one or the other would turn a blind eye, but that's a risk that the Israelis would have to take. If they overflew Iraq, they would be doing it with U.S. acquiescence, since the U.S. clearly would be capable of preventing them from doing so. And therefore, the U.S. would be implicated in this, even if it had not explicitly endorsed or supported it. In addition, the Israelis really can mount a single punitive strike. That is, they can do this once. And with the element of surprise, they can penetrate the air defenses, even overfly friendly country, overfly countries without their permission. But they can't mount a sustained aerial attack on Iran, which would be necessary not only to set the program back slightly, but to ensure that it wasn't then accelerated and that the Iranians didn't, as a result, get a bomb more quickly rather than less quickly.
Let's take a call right here from Waterloo, Iowa. Karen's calling. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call, Tom. My son is on his third deployment. First, he was with the National Guard, and now he is deployed on an aircraft carrier in the Strait with the Navy.
The Straits of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. He called yesterday from Bahrain. And I have to tell you that I think, frankly, Israel is playing fast and loose with our loyalties. It's my understanding that, and this is not from my son, but from what I've heard on NPR, that this is in part response to war games that Israel conducted last month. And I think that we have a moral obligation to our voluntary military and our voluntary armed forces to make certain that whatever we do is justifiable and founded on the best interests.
But Karen, can you blame Israel for being concerned about the possibility of a nuclear weapon in Iran?
I can say that I think restraint is better than saber rattling, and I'm disappointed by the lack of it.
Karen, thanks for calling. Emily Landau, there has been talk in the American media that Israel would be more likely to strike if it thought that Barack Obama might be elected president, with the sort of analysis that they would feel less certain of support in an Obama administration for action if they felt it necessary, and therefore might be prompted to go ahead before November.
Yeah, I know that there is that idea, there is that argument. Again, I don't think that it's helpful to deal with this issue by putting so much emphasis on possible military action and forgetting what the context is for this whole discussion.
No, we're not forgetting it. We're raising it. We're asking Karen here, but still.
Right. And I think, thinking about what the previous speaker who called in said about Israel playing fast and loose with U.S. interests, I find that a strange comment in light of the very clear position that the United States has taken on Iran over the past 5 years. The United States has been very clear with regard to what it will accept and not accept with regard to Iran's nuclear program. This is the problem. This is what needs to be dealt with. I think we should be focusing our energies on what kind of deal can actually be worked out with Iran. This is the real problem that needs to be dealt with. Negotiations so far have led nowhere. If we are now on the verge of some kind of breakthrough, and by the way, just a quick response to Trita, whether, you know, Iran does or does not respond to military threat, I think it's very clear that in 2003, Iran did respond to the threat of military attack. They were very sure that they would be next in line after Iraq, and we saw very different behavior in 2003, which was also reflected in the famous National Intelligence Estimate that came out December 2007.
Let's go to Holliston, Massachusetts, and Ren. Ren, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Terrific show. I'm hearing a whole lot of brinksmanship going on here, and our government, and particularly this administration, has a pretty poor track record on brinksmanship.
Poor in what sense? I mean, they when they've threatened, they've acted.
Well, that's the problem. When we went into Iraq for whatever purpose, as was just mentioned, Iran wanted to talk to us, and we kicked their overtures into the corner. Now that Ahmadinejad is blustering, they may or may not have nuclear weapons. The only people that I see as really adept at brinksmanship are the Israelis, and they have a populace that's willing to back them. I'm not even sure how much America is really even engaged in what's going on now.
Ren, it seems like we may have enough on our plate already, but let me put that to Ambassador Dobbins. Could we tumble into a military conflict accidentally with Iran, Ambassador, through brinksmanship?
Well, there's always the danger with sort of coercive diplomacy and threats of preemption that you, when the target of these threats doesn't respond appropriately, you're left with only one of two choices. One is to have your bluff called and back down, which is kind of humiliating. And the other is that you need to proceed to execute the threat. And that's one of the reasons why these threats of preemption are probably unwise in situations in which you haven't yet determined whether or not you are, in fact, ready to go to war.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour behind the saber rattling and diplomacy to try to gauge the real possibility of war with Iran, or maybe, a diplomatic breakthrough. What do you think on the war front? Is it unthinkable or all too possible? We've been joined from Tel Aviv in Israel by Emily Landau, Director of the Arms Control and Regional Security Program at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv. From Washington by Trita Parsi, President of the National Iranian American Council, formerly professor at Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies, and by Ambassador James Dobbins, now Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. Let's get a call from Des Moines, Iowa, and Jeffrey. Jeffrey, you're on the air.
Yeah, there seem to be sort of two elephants in the room that are missing from this discussion frequently. One is that Israel has nuclear weapons. And the second one is, you know, the possibility of Israel or the United States bombing Iran or airstrikes, which is, of course, a term Orwell would appreciate. But talk of war has become so normalized now. I mean, you do have the principles of Nuremberg. I mean, a country can just not invade or bomb another country if it wants to. And we have the UN Charter. You have a UN Security Council resolution is required. And I guess my point is, if Israel or the United States is going to try to attempt this, they're not going to be able to get a UN Security Council resolution. So, I mean, an unlawful use of force should be relevant to our public and should be part of the discussion. The other thing is, your guest from Iran just said preemption. Israel and the United States, neither one is arguing preemption. Preemption is customary international law and says if there is an imminent threat, a country can act. Both Israel and the United States are arguing preventive war, which in fact is what the Germans argued unsuccessfully at Nuremberg. So I just think that these things might be part of the discussion, or have we just entirely forgot the principles of Nuremberg?
Ambassador Dobbins, first to you on that. Is the talk of war too casual these days, or is this just where we've come?
I do believe that we're in a bizarre argument in the United States. It's not between those who think bombing Iran is a good idea and should be done, and those who think it's a bad idea and shouldn't be done. Rather, the two camps, the two campaigns, the two sides in this argument are those who think that we should talk to Iran first and only bomb them later if they don't do what we want, and those who think that these preliminaries, the discussions, are unnecessary. And that's the debate we've been conducting. We've avoided a debate on either the morality or the expediency of launching a preemptive or, if you prefer, a preventive attack on Iran. And I do think that it would be useful to have that second debate, which in some ways should be the more fundamental question.
Emily Landau, what's the mood in Israel? Is Israel interested in the UN Security Council's view of this, interested in a moral debate, ready for prevention, preemption?
I would just like to respond to Jeffrey by, first of all, saying that the comparison to Nuremberg I find very, very disturbing. But also I would like to remind him maybe of a third elephant in the room, and that is the fact that Iran has issued threats to wipe Israel off the face of the map. So I'm wondering what he thinks about those kind of statements and whether he still thinks that if military action would be taken, it would just be, you know, out of the blue for no reason. Israel is up against an enemy that has declared that they no longer want to see Israel as part of the Middle East. Israel has no quarrel with Iran. In fact, Israelis have no understanding of the tremendous amount of hostility that is directed against them from the direction of Iran's leaders. This is a very, very serious issue. When you couple this kind of rhetoric with possible nuclear weapons, you reach an equation that is very, very dangerous. And I would like to add, again, we can't make the mistake of reducing this whole issue to an Israeli-Iranian dynamic. There are other states in the Middle East that are seriously concerned by what's going on in Iran. I read a statement made by a researcher who's sitting in the Persian Gulf, in the Arabian Gulf, and he is saying that he would prefer military action to be taken than the option of Iran becoming a nuclear state. These are issues that must be taken into account when we analyze this situation. It's not solely an Israeli-Iranian dynamic.
Trita Parsi, the U.S. clearly has a very close relationship with Israel and a close military relationship with Israel. Do you see the United States, given the kind of stakes that Emily Landau is describing from Tel Aviv, do you see the United States at this point as having a veto over Israeli action, an effective veto, or not? Might Israel act with or without, even if the Pentagon is against it?
Well, first, let me say something. Emily mentioned earlier on that it's important that we actually talk about the Iranian nuclear program and put this thing into context, and I fully agree with her. But I think the threats and the bluster coming out of Israel in the last couple of weeks has created a situation in which all the callers are talking about the military option and seem to be quite opposed to it, and focus has in and of itself been taken away from the issue at hand, which is the Iranian nuclear program.
Well, those were Iranian missiles that were test fired. Ahmadinejad has made some, he's made some ameliorating comments,
but
blustery too.
Oh, without a doubt. My point is, though, that if we truly are interested in making sure that we talk about the issue at hand and get diplomacy going in order to be able to avoid a nuclear-armed Iran, then the military threats and bluster, whether coming from Tehran, Washington, or Tel Aviv, does not seem to be very, very useful. As to the question of whether the United States has a veto or not, I would just say that what Admiral Mullen said about 2 weeks ago was quite important, in which he, in response to a question about whether Israel would attack or not, said that the United States at this point cannot afford a third front, and argued that it would put too much strain on U.S. troops at this moment, is a very clear signal that the United States is not interested in seeing Israel starting something that it then expects the United States to finish.
Does that give the United States a veto? Does Admiral Mullen saying that mean it won't happen?
I wouldn't say that it necessarily gives the United States a veto, but I do believe that Israeli leaders are taking that statement quite seriously and that it has changed the dynamics a little bit.
James Dobbins, how do you read the power dynamics around this in Washington? Seymour Hersh saying that Dick Cheney has effectively kind of taken over, in some respects, the U.S.-Iran policy. Former U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., John Bolton, writing in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, if Israel's going to do it, we're going to be involved anyway, so let's help them do it. Then Admiral Mullen saying no. Where's the balance of power here, Ambassador?
Well, the balance clearly lies with the president, at least within the administration, and the president has so far sided with the doves on this issue, although not to the point of withdrawing the threats altogether. John Bolton has been very critical of the administration, savagely critical of President Bush and the administration for its handling of Korea. And so therefore, I don't think you should take his views on this as signaling the dominant view within the administration. That said, it's possible that the balance could shift. It's possible at some point that the president could alter his own position. But for the moment, he seems to have sided with the doves. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't some U.S. activities being undertaken against Iran of the sort that Cy Hersh wrote about.
Like what? What do you know there?
Well, I mean, what we know is the Iranians are sending agents across the border. The Iranians have been sending weapons to extremist Shia groups in Iraq that have been attacking Americans. And it's not impossible that the U.S. has decided on a tit-for-tat response. That is, they're not going to bomb Iran. They're not going to invade Iran. They're not going to make more of this than it deserves. But they're going to repay Iran in kind.
But Seymour Hersh was writing about
those kinds of activities in Iran. He's called it preparing the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
But I think a better explanation of it is because we're not going to invade Iran, so they're not preparing the battlefield in that sense. There's
absolutely no possibility
that we're going to invade Iran. But we may decide that instead of bombing Iran, we'll just conduct some special operations because the Iranians are already doing it. They'll understand it's a proportional response and it won't escalate.
When you say no possibility of invading Iran, do you mean even if there were airstrikes in Iran, there would not be a ground invasion along with it, or do you mean there's absolutely no possibility even of the air attack?
I mean, even if there were an air attack, it would not be accompanied by an effort to occupy Iran.
Trita Parsi, what about the Cy Hersh's notion that there's an effort here to provoke Iran into doing, I think, what they basically characterized as something stupid, of U.S. special forces maybe going after Iranian nuclear scientists, trying to provoke Iran into some action against minority groups there that would justify outside intervention? Do you see evidence of Tehran responding that way, or is it going the other way? They've talked about the U.S. now reopening some kind of mission in Tehran. Ahmadinejad expressed warmth toward that recently, and now the U.S. going to Geneva. Is the diplomatic front really the one heating up, Trita?
I think both fronts are heating up, but I do believe that obviously there's more promise in the diplomatic front. I think the step of sending Secretary Burns to Geneva is a very positive one, and hopefully it will help convince the Iranians to do a freeze for freeze. But then the question will be, can the freeze for freeze translate into a full suspension of uranium enrichment in Iran, which would then enable the United States to be a full participant in the talks? And for that to happen, I think we do have to reassess some of the objectives and strategies that we've had for over the last couple of years, and the first one being zero enrichment. I have a hard time seeing the Iranians agreeing to a full suspension if the objective of the talks are to eliminate Iran's enrichment capability rather than limiting them. I do believe that we do have a fair chance of being able to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran, even if Iran has limited enrichment capabilities. And that seems to be the more viable option right now.
Emily, what about Israel's red line here, if we can talk about it that way? How close, and does Iran have to back off of enrichment, go to zero enrichment to satisfy Israel, or what would move us back from a red line?
Well, that's a good question, and I think Israel's red lines in this regard are not very clear, and I would say that that's probably a good thing, that they have not been defined in a very, very clear and precise way, because that gives leeway for a different kind of dynamic. And, you know, I would agree that probably what we're seeing now, and perhaps as a result, you know, ironically perhaps, of the military talk, I think the diplomatic front might be heating up. But my major concern is that diplomacy will look very different from the diplomacy that we've seen so far. Diplomacy has to focus on the region. It has to focus on issues of regional influence in the Middle East. These are the issues that I think concern Iran actually the most. In other words, their whole nuclear program is a function of how they see themselves in the region, how they see their regional role. And so a real deal with Iran will have to address these issues. It's not going to be an easy negotiation. It will not be easy diplomacy. But I think the time to begin this diplomacy is right now.
Both Barack Obama and John McCain have talked about diplomacy, and recently Barack Obama with the greater emphasis. John McCain, of course, last year joked about bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. Would an Obama presidency, from Israel's perspective, be a problem with his emphasis on diplomacy, Emily?
Well, the problem with leaving this issue to the next administration is that it will probably take the next administration several months or up to half a year to reach the stage where they can, you know, start acting in a very determined fashion. I'm not sure that we have that much time. And it's my belief that, you know, this diplomatic track needs to start now. It needs to start with President Bush administration.
But what are you saying by
There's
that?
No
war
way
or
around
peace
it.
By November?
Excuse me?
War or peace by November?
I don't know if it'll be war or peace by November, but I think if we enter into, you know, a very determined diplomatic process right now, perhaps there could at least be the prospect of a deal on the horizon. But leaving this to the next administration, I'm afraid that, you know, we might not have that much time.
Let's get one more call here quickly from Madison, Wisconsin. Eric, you're on the air.
In November of last year, Senator Joe Biden said he would call for impeachment if the Bush administration went to war without a congressional declaration of war. I'm wondering why Senator Biden isn't talking about this and gathering support now. Could the threat of impeachment in the U.S. affect foreign policy of Israel?
James Dobbins, how do you interpret the mood on Capitol Hill right now? Would they be prepared to go along with whatever happens with the Bush administration here?
Well, it's getting a little late to impeach President Bush, and I don't think this. I think Biden was signaling seriously that Congress needed to be involved. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there's been nothing. There have been no consultations with Congress, which could be construed as a prelude to a conflict, and that's one of the reasons why a bolt from the blue seems unlikely. Congress would be divided on this issue and in general, as usual, sympathetic to Israel but concerned about the greater exposure to U.S. forces and U.S. interest in the region. I think Congress would very much prefer not to be faced with this sort of choice, and so far the administration has not forced the choice on them.
We've just got half a minute. What about Emily Landau's observation that the next presidency may be too late? That seems to put a very short clock on progress or movement here, Ambassador.
Well, I think that it would be desirable to make progress in these negotiations with Iran over the next few months, and the administration has made some important concessions in its stance, quite important concessions, over the last few weeks. which do offer the prospect that there could be, if not a full agreement, a breakthrough and a more positive spirit. In the absence of that, I think the deadline's going to have to be extended, and I think that while the Israeli government will be unhappy with that, they'll probably have to live with it.
Well, there's a picture for today. What it looks like tomorrow, who knows, but what a time. Ambassador James Dobbins joining us today from the Defense Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. Ambassador, thank you for being with us today.
Pleasure.
Trita Parsi with the National Iranian American Council, author of Treacherous Alliance. Trita, thank you very much for joining our conversation.
Thank you.
And Emily Landau at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv, Israel. Emily, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.